The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com, I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the New York Times bestselling author Richard Ford in with his brand new book, Canada. Richard, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
You know, a novel by the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. What did you win the Pulitzer Prize for, and what does it take to win that?
Luck. It takes luck. It has to be a year when Philip Roth didn't write his best book, I guess. I don't think that there's anything you can do. I won it for a book called Independence Day, which was published in 1975 or 6. I can't remember which. I think it's 5. And I was the last person on earth to think that this book would win the Pulitzer Prize. I had never won any prizes of any consequence before. So I was actually completely, I was out of the country when it was announced. I was living in France. And so it was completely a shock to me.
So do they get a hold of you and say, hey, Richard, listen, you know, your name was selected. Yeah. We chose you for the Pulitzer. How does that work?
Well, I'm actually not sure because the information had to kind of find its way to me. I was having dinner with Ernest Gaines in a little town in Brittany, and somebody got a cell phone call at the table where we were having dinner, and I took it outside. The guy said, it's for you. And I said, oh, that's very funny. I said, No one would call me here. I didn't even have a cell phone. So I took it out in the hall, and it was my French publisher, and he told me that I'd won. But Christina knew, my wife knew, because she was the head of city planning in New Orleans at the time, and she said she came back for lunch, and there was a stack of messages on her desk about 30 deep. And she said when she saw that, she said, oh, I know that you had won the Pulitzer Prize. But I didn't even know when the Pulitzer Prize was announced.
So Independence Day, what was that book about?
Well, it was a sequel to a book that I had written previously, which was called The Sports Writer. And this is narrated by the same narrator named Frank Bascom, who's a real estate agent in New Jersey. And it was about Frank taking his teenage son from New Jersey, picking him up at his mother's house in Connecticut, and taking him to the Baseball Hall of Fame, and also to the Basketball Hall of Fame for a kind of a father-son sort of get-together bonding event. And that's really what it's about. It's a book about a father taking his son on a trip like that.
Well, Canada, we're going on another trip with this book, I think. You know, there's this family, and the father starts out, what, in the Air Force?
Father's a lifer in the Air Force through Second World War, where he was a bombardier in a B-25. And the book takes place in 1960, so he's 15 years past the war. But he stayed in the service because, for I think the reasons that a lot of people stay in the service, because it took care of them. And he has a family. The book is set in Great Falls, Montana. And it's about the father getting out of the Air Force in 1960 and not really knowing what to do with himself and not really being used to taking care of himself. He's always been a government employee, and his wife and he are a little bit not alienated, but kind of heading in different directions. And by misadventure and fecklessness, he falls afoul of a bunch of Indians who threaten his life and scare him so badly that and threaten him with death, that he robs a bank to get some money that he needs to pay the Indians off a debt that he owes. And so from that, the whole book ensues.
Back in the 1960s, what was the economy like? Because it seemed like he had a hard time making money in that small town.
Well, it's a kind of a microeconomy in a town like Great Falls. Great Falls is an interesting town. It's right on the Missouri River in more or less north central Montana. It's more or less the middle of the state. And I say there is a microeconomy there because it's a market town. So it has railroad and it has big wheat grain elevators. It's got an enormous Air Force base. It's got a pretty good, even back in the 60s, it had a pretty good tourist attraction because of the river. The Missouri River runs through there. And so the economy, I think, was pretty good heading into the 60s, heading into the Kennedy election in 1960. Everybody was thinking that things were on the upswing.
Back in the 1960s, Montana, I mean, this town, pretty much like a lot of Western towns, pretty small and other towns far away, and maybe it was the major hub.
It was 50,000 people, and it's pretty much the same size today than, you know, 50 years later that it was then. But it is somewhat isolated. It's a wonderful place, I'll have to say. I've spent a lot of time there in my life, hope to spend more. I mean, it's got everything. It's got small-town life. It's sort of catching up with the creature comforts. It's got the river. It's got the mountains 60 miles away. It's right on the edge of the Great Plains. It's quite spectacularly beautiful. Close to Canada, if you care about that, and I do. So, but it is. It's isolated. Now, the airport probably doesn't work a whole lot better than your airport, but that's okay because as far as I'm concerned, it suppresses certain kinds of activity. So it's a wonderful place, really.
You know, without the Air Force there, that town really couldn't survive?
Who knows? I mean, it could survive because of the railroad and because of all of this farm agribiz that goes on there and because of the tourism. And it's also a town that's on Interstate 15, which comes up from Idaho and goes right to Lethbridge, Alberta. So, yeah, I think it could survive. I don't know if it could survive as lustily as it does, but it survives.
A tourist town. I mean, the Black Hills in South Dakota, kind of the touristy thing with the Mount Rushmore, the mm-hmm. Black Hills. Montana, they have the distinction, I guess, of being known where Custer's last stand was. Is this town fairly close?
No.
No.
The town that's fairly close to the Custer battlefield is Billings in Hardin, Montana, which is actually quite a ways to the east and to the south. What distinguishes Great Falls, it's where Lewis and Clark got out of the river, just downriver from Great Falls a little bit, but because of the falls, they got out of the river there and went overland afterwards. Yeah.
Would you say the family in Canada a little dysfunctional or not?
Well, you'd have to say, I guess, Mark, that any family whose parents rob a bank could be guilty of being dysfunctional, I think. Up until the point that the parents rob a bank and are immediately caught and put in jail. But up until that point, I would have said they were not dysfunctional. I would have said that they were, you know, looked at through the window glass of a car passing by a rather normal American family. Cohesive. Everybody loved everybody else. There was no particular strife. The strains in the marriage of the mother and the father are seemingly to me typical strains. It was a kind of a morganatic relationship insofar as the mother of this family is quite well educated and happens to be Jewish, and the father is a sort of a hillbilly from Alabama.
Although the parents of the wife didn't really think that she should be marrying somebody of that ilk.
Well, that's right. They were immigrants from Poland and had come to America in the late teens, had left really their lives behind, and they were quite cultivated, cultured people in Poznan, where they lived, in what is now Poland. Maybe it was Prussia then. But no, they wanted their daughter to marry a doctor. They wanted their daughter to marry somebody in their professions. And so the fact that she got pregnant and married this flyboy who was a bombardier was not what they wanted.
Tell me about the twins in this, their son and daughter.
Well, they are 15, and they are boy-girl twins, and the girl is a little bit developmentally ahead of the boy, as I think is typical, and beginning to have boyfriends and beginning to sneak out of the house at night, and the boy is much more disciplined, much more in his parents' force field than his sister is. And so they provide a kind of a nice, for me, little laboratory for examining the lives of adolescents, because they do so speak in different directions, so to speak.
The girl in the book, the twin girl, you make her out to be kind of a homely girl. Why is that?
I just wanted her to be. There's no whys to these things. It was what I thought one day. I assigned her a certain set of physical qualities and attributes which complied with something that I could sort of visualize. And I had a kind of, when I started writing about Berner, her name is Berner, B-E-R-N-E-R. When I first thought up her name, and I first imagined my narrator having a sister, it was this sort of child who came into my brain, sort of taller than usual, sort of beginning to have not a very good complexion, rather direct in her speech, sort of wiry-haired and not particularly pretty and you know, willing to conflict with her parents and beginning really to pull away from the sodality of the family.
As a writer, when you're writing Canada, do you have the beginning, middle, end? Do you maybe have the beginning? Do you not know where you're going?
Oh, I always know where I'm going. For me, that would be real folly not to know where I was going, because I would go everywhere but where I needed to go. For me, it's really crucial to spend a year not writing, amassing information, imagining where the book will start spatially, imagining what sort of stations it will pass through along the way to a kind of spatial end. In other words, I have to know where on the map it's going to end. So before I start, I don't know all the connective tissues. I don't know how one thing that I know relates or connects to the next thing that I know and the next thing that I want the book to transit through. But I know all the large major stations of the arc of the book.
So you do an outline before, or is it all in your head?
Oh, I'd hate to call it an outline. I amass information in a big notebook, and the kind of notebook that a fourth grader would bring to class. And into that notebook, I have dividers. And I have a divider which is dedicated to the narrator, a divider dedicated to the sister, a divider dedicated to Montana, to both parents, to all the characters in the book, and to all the book's other formal features. And so I am constantly for a year putting material, raw material, unedited, more or less undigested, into these folders. And so when I start getting ready to write, I just study this big notebook the way you'd study for a bar exam. And through the course of that study, what I do is I figure out that thing we were just talking about. I figure out what the arc of the book would be and where it should start and where it should end.
Have you ever started writing, the characters start to talk to you? Perhaps they do, perhaps they don't. And they tell you which way really to go or what they look like?
I'm the boss here.
Okay.
Because I'm going to get the glory and I'm going to get the blame. So I can't, you know, when writers say, well, you know, I just channel my characters. My characters just start speaking to me. I don't know. Well, it seems to me to be a complete resignation of responsibility. That isn't what authorship is. Authorship means that you authorize everything. So I've never had an occasion when I felt that my characters were autonomous.
Richard, your last book out probably in soft cover was what?
Well, this is my last book, just out in Soft Cover Canada, which was just published in January of this year. Prior to that, I wrote a book called The Lay of the Land, which was about 6 years ago, which was the third in a series of books, Independence Day having been the middle one, Sports Writer the first. It's now, I guess you can say, a trilogy. Although I've gone back now to writing about the same narrator again, only in short story form. So I guess I'm just going to, it's typical of me too. I'm just going to mine this seam till it exhausts. I mean, you're only given so much as a writer. And I figured that if I can, as I say, mine a seam rather than be all over the map, I'll probably get the best out of myself. I mean, that's what writers are trying to do. Writers are trying to get the best out of themselves, to get themselves fully expressed, by which I mean to get as much of the stuff that they value and that they seem as important, into their books. They're not trying to express themselves in a personal way, express their opinions. They're trying to make something where before there was nothing. And for me, I think, writing about Frank Bascom over the course of 25 or 30 years is the best way to get that out of myself.
The last book you said about 6 years ago, why so long between?
It doesn't seem long to me. I don't know. When we're not talking about, you know, manufacturing bar stools here, we're talking about writing rather large, serious, complicated, but also at the same time completely accessible novels. I mean, nobody ever said to Dostoevsky, "Why aren't you writing more books?" You know, no. I mean, to get the best out of myself, to be as good as I can possibly be, I just have to take my time. I mean, I know it's not very modern to say that when all gratifications need immediate treating. But for me, I guess I'm of a generation, and I also am dyslexic. So everything takes me longer. But I am of a generation in which speed was not quite as important as it seems to be today.
A lot of other authors that I talk to say that they're pretty much on a deadline, a book a year. They've got to get that out.
The publicist, poor them. Poor book.
I know.
Poor reader.
So your agent, publicist, just fine.
Oh, sure. I mean, if I wrote a book a year, they wouldn't be any good. So why should I write a book a year? I mean, most people who write a book a year write books that aren't any good. So, you know, but moreover, I mean, John Grisham is a counterexample. He writes these books a book a year, and they are actually pretty good. Good homeboy for me, a Mississippian. But for me, I just wouldn't write good books if I did it more quickly than I do.
With a book like Canada, how much research do you have to do? I mean,
as little as possible.
Yeah, because you're probably a child from the 60s anyway.
I am. And I was about the age that this boy is who's narrating this book in 1960. I try to do as little research as possible, not because I'm immune to research or because I don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy it. But I need to work with material that I can have a kind of sensuous, committed, engaged intellectual relationship with. So if I just go dig stuff up on Google, or if I get my assistant to give me a big notebook full of stuff that she's dug up for me, it's not everything in that notebook that I can get my brain around. It has to have some kind of what Henry James called availability for me. And not every piece of just rote material off the internet or out of some other research source can I really feel is available to me. In Canada, there's a reference to the Space Needle. The Space Needle in 1960 was not quite finished. I think it was finished around 61, maybe early 62. But it figures in my book sort of partially, but there was something about the Space Needle for me which made me just want to get it into the book. But that isn't true with everything else that was going on. I mean, the Democratic National Convention, for instance, which also took place in the summer of 1960 when this book starts, I didn't have much of a relationship with that. The whole tete-a-tete between Kennedy and Nixon, that was going on. That was material that I could have used. I just didn't have a feel for that. You got to use material that you have a feel for. And then, you know, that's not something you can really completely define, what that feel is, but you know it when you have it. We all have that kind of relationship with otherwise seemingly extrinsic material.
You know, one of my favorite parts in the book was in the back roads of Montana. We're in an older car. The windows are down because there's no air conditioning. It's a dirt road. The dirt's just billowing from the back, and it's almost like you're right there, right along with the family. How do you get that from pen to paper into people's imaginations?
That's a very good question, and I probably could never answer it very satisfactorily. You know, like they always said, practice, practice, practice. I probably engage some memories of my own, but I don't want to attribute everything that goes into a novel to be autobiographical, because that would sell my imagination short. And indeed, when I was a teenager, I wasn't in north central Montana. I was driving around southwest and southeastern Louisiana with my father, who was a traveling salesman. But we didn't have air conditioning in the cars then. And while we were not on dusty roads, we were on hot roads, hot, humid roads. So, you know, transliterating one event into another event is probably part of the job description for novelists. And I've been on a lot of those roads in my life, living in Montana. And so it was one of those things, again, that I had a kind of a feel for. What would it smell like? What would the sound be out the window? How would the air feel? Would it be dry? Of course it would be. Would you taste the dust in your mouth? And when you start participating in the scene that you're actually trying to describe, and you could participate in those visceral, sensuous ways, well, then finding language for it is much easier.
You've been writing for how long?
I've been writing since 1968.
So how has things...
Long as I've been married, 45 years.
So how have things changed for you, an author? I mean, probably at one time, were you writing longhand, then went to a typewriter?
I still write longhand.
Do you?
Yeah, I still write with an ink pen. My practices haven't changed in the least. I still write in longhand, and I still type it out. Now I type it out onto a computer, but all of my editing of pages I do on the page. I don't write anything new on the computer. I can type so much faster than I can think. I want what comes off the end of my pen to be fairly in close order to what I'm thinking at that time. I can exercise governance over sentences much more profitably with a pen than I can on a computer. You know, on a computer screen, everything looks pretty good. Everything looks where it belongs. You can't even find, if you're me, as a dyslexic, you can't even find typographical errors half the time. So it just, again, that sense of governance is important to me. I take authorship seriously, and that's how I can exercise authorship.
As you're writing a book like Canada, putting it from longhand onto the typewriter, are you reading it out loud afterwards to edit?
I am. I'm reading it out loud all the time. And that's good and it's bad. It's good because I can then be responsible for every jot, every word choice, every pause. It makes, and this is a book told by a character who's 65 years old, it makes the book submissive to my own speaking voice. And while that has some benefits, it also has some drawbacks, I think, because my speaking voice is my speaking voice. And I want characters to seem to be independent of myself, of my person. And I want characters to be able to articulate thoughts that are somewhat more, often are, more complex than my speaking voice can articulate. I have to get to a point at which I don't read it out loud to myself anymore so that I can actually let it achieve the autonomy or the appearance of autonomy from me that I want it to have. Because it's not, you know, the novels I write are not about me. Sometimes they contain things that I believe and sometimes they contain things that I don't. My students at Columbia, critics are always talking about truth. Is this true? And I try to make them understand that the truth of something on the page may be something that differs from what you yourself personally believe.
So with all your teachings through the years, have you ever molded that best-selling author?
I haven't taught that much. I only taught about 5 years in the 45. I've taught a few writers who go on having writing lives, yeah. I can't remember if I had any who were bestsellers or not. I was more interested in me becoming one than I was them, frankly.
So what if I were to ask one thing that would make me a success at writing, what would that be?
Be a good reader.
Who do you like to read?
Well, you know, I'm a hungry reader. Like most people who had a liberal arts education, I found out more about books that I hadn't read than books that I had. So I'm always sort of taking one step forward with a contemporary writer like James Salter. And then I'm grabbing back in the back and reading, you know, some book from Jane Austen that I don't remember having read back in 1961, 62. So I'm just omnivorous, you know. I just read whatever I could read. But Jackson Brown is a pal of mine, and we were talking on the phone a couple of days ago. And it was actually an email. It wasn't on the phone. Sometimes I can't remember if I emailed somebody or I talked to them. But he was saying, you know, I should be writing songs. He said, I should really be writing songs. He said, but all I want to do is read books. And I think to myself, I understand that. I should be writing stories. All I want to do is read books.
All right, so Canada, how long in the making was this book? How long does it take you to actually put the pen to a book like this and finish it?
This book took 2 years to write the first time through. And then there was a year prior to that when, as I said before, when I just amassed and accumulated all the information and details and lines of dialogue and descriptions which were going to go into the book. And then once the book is written all the way through, there's usually the better part of a year spent editing it and getting it into the final shape that you see in front of you now. So 4 years get consumed somehow or other. That's the part I don't like. It's the part after the book is finished, when you have to niggle with it and niggle with it and niggle with it and try to get every word in place. And of course, you have to do that because that's the job. But it's the part I like least.
Canada, your brand new book takes place in Montana.
It also takes place in Saskatchewan.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Which is why the book's called Canada.
Right.
But it's starting out in Montana.
Yes.
All right. Let's find out. Let's go back to the 60s with Richard Ford. Find out what led up to a bank robbery and why the move to Canada. And we'll also find out about the narrator of Richard Ford's new book, Canada. Richard, before we go, is there a way we can find out maybe more about Canada?
My book?
Your book.
Only by reading it.
All right.
Only by going to your local independent bookseller and buying a copy.
There you have it. From Richard Ford. Richard, thanks a lot.
Great, Mark. Nice to talk to you.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Richard Ford, author of his brand new book, Canada.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.